Good evening and welcome to the January 15th installment of K-Chung Radio's The Talking Show.
Steve, you're a week behind. It's January 22nd.
My name is Steve Cato and I'm back collecting those frequent flyer miles I like to collect so much of, flying back and forth between Austin, Texas and Los Angeles. And I'm back here in Los Angeles for Wednesday night only. And joining me in the studio is my dear friend and a friend to you out there in Radioland, Nicholas Miller.
Hey, Steve. Always a pleasure to see you. I'm so glad this radio show affords us the budget to bring you out every week.
Yeah.
Every week.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't watch the debate last night. I was so put off by the sudden rancorous tone that the Sanders-Warren camps, the way that that was shaping up, that I just decided to forget the whole thing.
I haven't watched any of them, to be honest. I just can't handle it.
Yeah, and I mean, I can't even vote anyway, so I don't even know why I'm so concerned. I mean, I have opinions, and
That you do, Steve.
I want my friends who are American citizens to make good choices, and I want my friends who are American citizens to have things like free at the point of service medical care. But I don't...
Yeah, wouldn't that be something? Free medical care.
I can't change that. You know, it's it's foreign election
if only
interference.
You
if I tell anyone what specifically to do, I guess.
Oh, really? Huh.
Yeah.
Be careful.
Exactly. And K-Chung Radio really doesn't need that kind of scrutiny. Not right now.
No, it's a gentle, tender affair at the moment.
But I was thinking about last week's guest, Kirk Douglas, following on the heels of Michael Douglas, mm-hmm. his son, and thinking how, you know, those aren't the only intergenerational hunks who are sort of in the same business.
Oh, really? Let's hear this, Steve.
And
because those are two pretty good ones, if you ask me.
Although, again, it's not our theme of erotic thrillers of the 1990s. It is on the theme of like father, like son. So, you know, if both Michael and Kirk Douglas are handsome leading men, what other dynamic father son duos are there? And I thought immediately about our guest.
Who, Steve? Who?
That's right. Our guest is Sam Ashley.
Oh,
and,
perfect.
He is, of course, the son of Robert Ashley.
Oh, one of our favorites. Favorites.
Very debonair gentleman who...
Sans ice.
Is a big influence on the talking show.
Perhaps the biggest. Robert Ashley and Adorno.
Yeah, pretty big deal for us in the talking show. And, you know, the work of Robert Ashley, the melodious talking of Robert Ashley.
So beautiful.
Is a big part of what the talking show is about. And
it's true.
So it's great that, you know, this isn't a special set of skills that dies with one generation. And that Sam continues to do smooth talking, much like his father did. So I thought, what better opportunity than to have Sam in. And of course, you know, we wouldn't do this normally, but since Sam is, you know, from one of the most august talking lines in America, we let him bring a musician.
Ooh.
With him. So he's accompanied by Werner Durand.
Ugh.
So, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Sam Ashley and Werner Durand.
Mm-hmm. Happiness is not a function of experience. I mean, it's not the result of experiences in this real world, the world of experiences. Happiness is the truth about matter, a direct expression of the nature of things. The search for happiness is a misunderstanding. Like the invention of agriculture, the search for happiness is a solution to a problem that never existed. Around the time of the big California gold rush, pioneers like the Donner Party had a strange infatuation with the western part of North America. Manifest destiny. Go out west to the Oregon and California territories. The pioneers were obsessed with the idea that it was their fate that this part of the world would belong to them, and that their conquest of it would improve the lives of everyone, would make everyone happy. The Donner Party started their westward journey in the spring of 1846. George Donner and James Reed were the leaders. Donner was a successful farmer and adventurer who had already emigrated 5 times. Reed was a wealthy Illinois businessman, eager to increase his fortune out west, having read about the promise of a vast, undeveloped land. 33 people set out from Springfield, Illinois with high hopes. Virginia Reed wrote in her diary, quote, "The road at first was rough and led through a timbered country, but after striking the great valley of the Platte, the road was good and the country beautiful. Stretching out before us as far as the eye could reach was a valley as green as emerald, dotted here and there with flowers of every imaginable color, and through this valley flowed the grand old Platte, a wide, rapid, shallow stream. Exercise in the open air under bright skies and freedom from peril combined to make this part of our journey an ideal pleasure trip. How I enjoyed riding my pony, galloping over the plain, gathering wild flowers," unquote. Their first stop, about 3 weeks into their journey, was Independence, Missouri, where the Oregon Trail began and where they could replenish their supplies. For a while, they traveled with a larger wagon train, perhaps 1,500 people altogether, some headed for California and some for Oregon. Eventually, though, each group went its own way. When they reached the Little Sandy River in Wyoming, the Donner Party consisted of 89 people, including 2 Native American guides. There, they chose to take a shortcut across Utah and Nevada called the Hastings Cutoff, a direct route across the Great Basin that had been described by Lansford Hastings in his book, The Emigrant's Guide to Oregon and California. The Hastings Cutoff passed over the Wasatch Mountains and across the Great Salt Lake Desert. Hastings was a young lawyer from Ohio who had gone west in 1842 and who thought that he might one day be president of the Republic of California. At Fort Laramie, James Reed had met an old friend from Illinois named James Clyman, who had just traveled the Hastings Cutoff with Hastings, returning from California. Clyman warned Reed not to take the cutoff, but Reed, eager to arrive early in California, ignored the warning. Hastings has often been blamed for the Donner Party's misfortunes, but when Mormon settlers came into the Salt Lake Valley only 1 year later, they followed the Donner Party's route down Emigration Canyon. Also, Hastings had made the trip with another wagon train, and they had arrived safely in California. And the book written by Hastings devotes but one sentence to the cutoff. Probably historians uncomfortable with the idea of holding the Donner Party themselves accountable prefer the notion that the pioneers were victims of circumstance. In any case, things were not looking good for the Donner Party. The families were by this time mistrustful of each other. They argued and all doubted the wisdom of having chosen this route, but saw no alternative. Luke Halloran died of tuberculosis, then known as consumption. A Belgian man named Hardcope was murdered by another of the pioneers, who only admitted this later on his deathbed. William Pike was accidentally shot. John Snyder, a hired hand, was killed by James Reed, who was then exiled from the wagon train. Near Truckee Lake, now called Donner Lake, in the Sierra Nevada Mountains, most of the party, some 60 people, made ready for winter in cabins that had been built by pioneers that had come this way before. There were the Reed, Breen, Graves, Murphy, Caseburg, and Eddy families, along with hired hands. The Breen family occupied one cabin, the Eddy and Murphy families took another, the Reed and Graves families occupied a third. Caseberg constructed a lean-to for his family at the side of the cabin occupied by the Breens. Meanwhile, the Donner family had made camp some distance away in Alder Creek Valley after they had fallen behind when George Donner had injured himself repairing a broken wagon wheel. The weeks passed, the snow fell, the food ran out, the animals died. The strongest of the immigrants, 12 men and 5 women, including the 2 Native American guides, went in search of help. Meanwhile, Charles Stanton, who had gone on ahead to find help, returned from Sutter's Fort, now known as Sacramento, the capital of California, with 7 mules, beef and flour, plus 2 more Indians. Sutter had many Native American slaves, and he sent 2 of them, Luis and Salvador, with this first rescue party. Shortly after that, James Reed, after having been banished when he had killed the hired hand, arrived at Sutter's Fort, and he began organizing the second relief party. Back at Donner Lake, the entrenched party ate the animals, followed by the hides they had used to repair the leaky roofs, followed by their leather clothing. They took apart their precious snowshoes to eat the oxhide webbing, and then they ate each other. Usually they waited until a comrade was dead before eating him or her, but in a few select instances they didn't necessarily follow even this rule. Some were making plans to kill and eat Luis and Salvador, but Mr. Eddy warned the Indians, who were able to leave quietly in the night, obliged to save themselves from the people they had come to rescue. Their supplies were limited, though, especially considering their hasty exit, and they were overtaken, shot by William Foster, and eaten. Patrick Dolan, ranting deliriously, stripped off his clothes and ran into the woods. He returned soon afterwards and died a few hours later. Some of the group began to eat flesh from Dolan's body. Lemuel's sister tried to feed some to her brother, but it was no use, and he died a short while later. The next morning, the group stripped the muscle and organs from the bodies of Antonio, Dolan, Graves, and Murphy, and dried it to keep for the days ahead, taking care that nobody would have to eat their relatives. 2 months and 4 rescue parties later, there was only one man, Luis Caseberg, left alive among the mutilated remains of his companions. When the third relief party left the campsite, 4 people were alive. But by the time the 4th rescue team arrived, Caseberg was the only person left. Many of the reports say that the rescuers found him surrounded by disfigured corpses, a kettle of cooking human flesh, buckets of human blood, and a large frying pan filled with fresh human livers and lungs, and that on the ground nearby there were 3 uneaten ox legs. Caseberg said that his fellow pioneers had died natural deaths, and that he had ignored the ox meat because it was too tough and lacked flavor. Caseberg insisted until his death that he had not murdered anyone, and that he had only reluctantly eaten human flesh. Quote, "It makes my blood curdle to think of it," unquote, he told Charles McGlashan, a local newspaper publisher that wrote a book about the Donner Party. Quote, "It has been told that I boasted of my shame, said that I enjoyed this horrid food. It is a horrible, revolting falsehood," unquote. Until just recently, no one thought to ask whether the Native Americans that lived in those mountains might have a memory of the tragedy. When the Donner Party arrived at the east side of the Truckee Meadows, they were entering the home of the Wellmell-Tee, now known as the Washoe Indians. In fact, there were many Wellmell-Tee settlements in the area. The party had passed some of their camps. The Wellmell-Tee of that era are usually designated hunter-gatherers by anthropologists. Fish were a big part of their diet, pine nuts and acorns too. The Wellmell-Tee had 2 distinct kinds of settlements. There were the year-round permanent homes, and those were distinguished in their language from short-term or intermittent camps. People spent the entire winter in the permanent settlements because food, firewood, and other resources were considered plentiful. At least one of these permanent year-round settlements, where the Wellmell-Tee considered life to be good, was very near to where the surviving members of the Donner Party were desperately enduring their hell. Up To that point, the Whale Meltee had had almost no direct contact with European Americans. They may have had some limited contact with early Spanish explorers, and then later with fur trappers in 1826, and the southern Washoe, Hung Alelti, had observed the Barlston Bidwell party in 1841, but emigrant party records make no mention of contact with Washoe Indians. Scouts were always sent to keep track of anybody passing through their territory, but it's likely that for most of the Whale Meltee, the Donner Party were the first white people they ever saw, and it's from the Donner Party that they got their first impressions of European Americans. At that time of year, the Whale Meltee family groups would have gone to their favorite fishing spots on the streams that flowed into Donner Lake and into the Truckee River, or along the streams of the high mountains. The best fishing spots were between Donner Lake and the Truckee River, and they would have begun the storage of acorns and of the pine nuts that they had gathered just to the east of Donner Lake. Those that traditionally fished near Donner Lake had been warned about the Donner Party by other groups. They were astonished by the stories they were told. A man called One Who Talks to the Storm, because he was noted for his ability to call on the wind or to chase away a storm, recalled a time when members of a scouting party had returned and spoken about the strange foreigners. The scouts had seen that the strangers were starving and had tried to bring them a deer and other food, and one brave man had even tried to throw fish across the ice to them. But each time they had tried to bring food, they had been shot at. In fact, one Whale Meltee man that came too close to the strangers' camp was shot, and he died, and this discouraged them from trying to help. Some people even moved away from the area because the strangers were cannibals, and they were afraid that they too might be eaten. One man had gone to the foreigners' camp and had been offered a human hand. Quote, "That scared him so badly he never went back there, even to fish in the stream," unquote. Some still tried to help, though, by leaving dried rabbit and wild potatoes near the strangers' cabins. It seems odd, but today the story of the Donner Party is regarded as something heroic. People versus nature. At the site of the tragedy, there's a monument, a testament to a struggle, more or less like the kind one sees at sites memorializing events in a war, as if the Donner Party had waged a valiant war with circumstances. But how should we understand the difference between the story as told by the Whale Meltee and the standard historical account? So-called skeptics would smugly say that the only difference is that the Indians knew the area and the pioneers didn't. And that must be part of the answer. After all, the pioneers had, for the most part, lived in towns. But what about people that, for example, fall from great heights without being hurt? Like the woman, aged 42, 157 centimeters, 5 feet 2 inches tall, and weighing 57 kilograms, 125 pounds, that jumped from the 6th floor into a garden, landing on her side and back with, quote, "no evidence of material injuries or shock," unquote. Or the woman, aged 36, 163 centimeters, 5 feet 4 inches, tall, and weighing an estimated 52 kilograms, 115 pounds, that jumped from an 8th floor and fell onto a fence face downward. The doctors that examined her said, quote, "there was no evidence of material injury," unquote. She immediately picked herself up and walked to a nearby clinic. The doctors said, quote, "in this case, chief interest is centered on the patient's having struck a 2.5 by 10 centimeter, 1 by 4 inch, wooden fence edge up at the top of the fence without injury," unquote. Others have fallen from similar heights and landed unharmed, face down, on things like steel bars. Like the man, aged 42, of unascertained height and weight, that fell from the 10th floor and landed on the hood and fenders of an automobile face downward. Quote, "this patient survived and is now in good health. At the time of the accident, the patient was reported to have sustained no loss of consciousness, to have slept well, and to have had a good appetite," unquote. Or the man that fell from the top of a cliff 96 meters, 320 feet high, bounced off a ledge halfway down, then landed on his head on the rocks below. with minor injuries that cleared up in 10 days? And what about the 22-year-old New York man that jumped from the 39th floor of a skyscraper, landed on a car, crushed the roof, broke through the rear window, and survived? And then there's the Russian man that jumped drunk from the 5th floor window of his apartment onto the concrete below and was fine, twice. He said he jumped the second time because he couldn't take his wife's nagging him about having jumped the first time. Or in China, when a young woman walking down the street looked up and saw a baby falling, she caught the child who had fallen from a window on the 10th floor. Or how about the German librarian who, as a teenager, fell more than 3 kilometers, 2 miles, and landed with only minor injuries when the plane she was on came apart over the Peruvian rainforest. She remembers falling and seeing the jungle spinning below her before she lost consciousness. Apparently that's typical. That high up, the air is so thin that one conks out. Usually one wakes up at a certain altitude, but she woke up on the ground the next day, surrounded by debris and with only a broken collarbone. Actually, in that instance, 15 people survived the fall, but the others died before rescue teams found them. Or the flight attendant that fell 10,160 meters, 33,330 feet, landed on the side of a mountain, slid down in the snow, and survived. And of course, there are stories like the one of the 7-year-old boy that went over Niagara Falls when the boat he was in turned over and survived. Or how about the 18-month-old boy that fell from a 7th-floor balcony in Paris, bounced off of an awning, and landed unharmed in the arms of a doctor that just happened to be walking by? The awning, incidentally, would normally have been closed, but the mechanism for closing it happened to be broken that day. When the plot of life unfolds, it can do so in an infinite variety of ways, and when it does, everything agrees. Coincidence, the skeptics smugly say. Coincidence, luck, magic. Yes, that's exactly how it works, don't you see?
What is this heaven we speak of? A place past the mountains at the edge of the earth. You can't find heaven by searching, and the soul doesn't exist. There is only transcendence. Oneness is illusion, aim only for transcendence. What is this heaven we speak of? What can one say of the blessings of heaven? There will be health and no sickness, liberty and no servitude, beauty and no ugliness, immortality and no decay, abundance and no want, repose and no cares, security and no dread, knowledge and no error, joy and no sorrow, honor and no contention. He must have been kidding. All live and die equally. In death there is the equality of rottenness and putrefaction. Neither can be prevented.
creation of the world by coincidence. The big beasts eating the little beasts. The little beasts doing the best they can. There is no heaven after death. Only the soul, the transcendental self. On January 14, 2014, a young lady saw a creature she described as like a werewolf, only scarier. She was sitting on her front porch, an enclosed patio with a few large windows. One window was open in front, beside the front door. It was after 11 p.m. and visibility was good, up to 100 feet because of the street lights. As she sat, she noticed movement. She thought it was someone walking down the railroad tracks. She looked up and saw something that blew her mind. It was, in her words, a thing that had the head of a dog, almost exactly like a German shepherd. But it was walking upright like a person on two legs. She said she saw its eyes, and that's when she noticed it was staring at her. She said that she became lost in its eyes. The creature was covered in hair or fur. She estimated the height in the neighborhood of 7 feet. Maybe just a bit less. The creature took a couple steps toward her when she saw a flash of light. The creature then spun around and ran off. The perfect ones of old borrowed the path of benevolence for the occasion and dwelt in righteousness for a night. Thus they rambled in the vacancy of untroubled ease. Found their food in the fields of indifference. Untroubled ease requires the doing of nothing. Indifference is easily supplied with nourishment. They called this the enjoyment that collects the truth. Enter eagerly into the treasure house that lies within you, and you will see the treasure house of heaven. For the two are one and the same. And there is but one single entry into them both. Heaven has no special feeling of kindness, but so it is that the greatest kindness comes from it. Perfect enjoyment is the overflowing contentment of nature. Perfect stillness is the disinterestedness of it. It cannot be conveyed by words nor by silence. In that state which is neither speech nor silence, its transcendental nature may be apprehended. The simplest understanding is best. Heaven cannot exist. If it existed, it could not be non-existent. Predestination and chance, how can they bear upon the infinite? Storm sent from heaven, children born of earth, the highest walls, the broadest walls. Like a flood, it passes from house to house, it breaks through. No door can shut it out. No bolt can turn it back. Under the door like a snake it glides. Through the hinge like a wind it comes. Always by surprise, like sleep, like death. A tsunami in the mountains at the edge of the earth. The waterfall. This encounter occurred not long after I had bought the car. My friend Sean and I were out just driving around the local towns and villages, playing tunes on the cassette and cruising about. It was dark by the time we passed through the small coastal village of Cresswell, Northumberland, so I'm guessing that it was around 11 at night. We were heading southwest from Cresswell to Ellington on Cresswell Road. I had not had the chance yet to test the fog lights on the car. I told Sean that I was going to switch them on as he was searching in the glove box for another cassette. We were approaching a slight right-hand bend. There was a 6-foot wall with dense foliage on our left, and a normal hedgerow bordering a field to our right. That's when I saw something run into the middle of the road. I wasn't going very fast, maybe 30 miles per hour. I had plenty of time to slow down so I wouldn't hit it, even time to stop, though I'm not sure I did. I think I just crawled the car towards it, as I couldn't believe what I was seeing. It had run out onto the road from my right and had stopped in the middle of the road looking directly at the car. It was covered in thick gray-brown fur about 2 to 3 inches long and stood on its rear legs, which were jointed with the knee at the rear like a horse or dog's. It had one foot in front of the other in mid-step. As it seemed, I had caught it by surprise. I remember the eyes which reflected the light back at me as being perfectly round and a green-yellow color, much like that of a cat's eyes when caught in the light. It stood about 5 to 6 feet tall. It had what seemed to be a very muscular body, not big or bulky, more wiry with powerful limbs, thick chest, and small waist. Its head and face were like that of a dog or a goat, not flat like a human's, but with a muzzle and large ears. I assume it regained its composure after being caught off guard as it took off over the 6-foot wall and through the foliage atop that in a single bound. As for how I felt, I was in shock at first, like when someone gives you a fright. I shouted, "Sean, Sean," to make sure he was looking as he was fishing around in the glove box for a tape. I just couldn't take it all in. After it had gone, we were still going slow. We were looking back to where it had disappeared, and I felt terrified. I've always considered myself a fairly watchful type and not easily scared, but there was no chance of me getting out of that car to follow it. It's very hard to talk about it, as quite frankly, most people don't believe it, but hand on heart, all I have said is true. Although I often drive by the same area, I have never seen it again. I can't tell you how excited I was when I found out someone else had seen it. We see that humility is essential before seeing why. To seek consciousness is false. To concentrate on anything, even emptiness. Nature is empty. To simply be without thoughts, nature is pure. Such a state is called the function of thoughtlessness. To strive for emptiness, to refrain from thinking of anything so that thoughts are suppressed, is experience. To eliminate thought is effort. Effort obscures nature. Who was that king that was doomed to roll the stone uphill forever? It was around 11:30 p.m. on November 4, 2009. For the past few months, we've had some construction on the surrounding roads. I was coming off the exit for the 133 road connector, and I'll never forget what I saw. While stopped at the light, I saw three very large, four-legged creatures dash out from the trees along the road. I started second-guessing and tried to convince myself that I was seeing things. I made the left turn at the light, and while the speed limit was still 40 miles per hour at this part, I looked up and almost peed my pants. Those three beasts were running upright on two legs. The wolves, which seems to be the most logical guess, were about 6.5 feet tall, and they looked like they easily weighed 250 to 275 pounds each. They had snouts and mouths that could almost be expressive, and the fur was dark. I was going 45 miles per hour, and the giant wolves were easily keeping up with me. I then literally put the pedal to the metal and sped up to 70. I was sweating profusely and having a panic attack. As I sped up to 70, the wolves stopped following me, considering I was about to enter a high-traffic part of the road. The wolf in front seemed to stop on a dime and watch me drive off. I told my girlfriend what I saw, and she deemed my imagination was running wild. I also told my co-workers the next day, but nobody believes me. I know I'm not crazy, and I know what I saw. I still have been taking the same route home every night and have not run into anything since that night. Who knows what they actually were? But all I know is I don't want to run into them again. The existence of the soul can never be proven because it doesn't exist. The opposite of heaven is not hell. The opposite of heaven is complacency. To eliminate self is a misunderstanding. Open the door to heaven. Lucid dreaming is not hard to choose what to dream. Try touching things in dreams. Try choosing subjects for dreaming. Try to make all transitions easy, effortless. A bit more difficult is the way back. To project a version of yourself that others perceive in the world or in a dream. But that too is not so hard. With a little practice, you can push yourself into another universe. On the sea, on the ocean, on the island, on the empty pasture gleams the moon. On an ash stalk lying in a green wood in a gloomy vale, toward the stalk wanders a shaggy wolf, horned cattle seeking for his sharp white fangs. But the wolf enters not the forest, but the wolf dives not into the shadowy vale. Moon, moon, gold. Check the flight of bullets, blunt the hunter's knives, break the shepherd's cudgels, cast wild fear upon all cattle, on men, on all creeping things, that they may not catch the gray wolf, that they may not rend his warm skin. My word is binding, more binding than sleep, more binding than the promise of a hero. A 55-year-old man who works as a physical therapist decided to walk his Malamute dog on August 23, 2015 at about 12:30 on a bright night. The weather had been too warm for the dog in the daytime. They set out on a pleasant park trail with no problem viewing the surroundings. He noticed something strange as they neared upon. There were two figures, one lying on the ground and the other crouching over it. As he watched, the crouched figure stood up. He quickly realized that the figure on the ground was a dead deer. Then he tried to identify the now upright beast. Its large head featured tall, pointed ears and a long muzzle, and he described its torso and upper legs as densely muscular with a thin waist. He also noted that it walked on its toe pads like a dog does, and thought the creature weighed something over 225 pounds and stood about 6 feet tall. The man and dog backed carefully away until they reached a spot where they could run to the car. I do not know what I saw as far as an exact species, he said, but I absolutely know it is something that is not recognized by professional zoology. This man does not drink and says he has never had paranormal experiences. He now walks his dog near home. There are things which don't exist in the usual sense, but which exist enough to be known. Spirits are not figments of the imagination. They're found inside and outside too. They show themselves as coincidences inside and outside. Steve Krueger was working as a contractor for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. He was hired to pick up roadkill. On the night of November 9, 2006, at around 1:30 in the morning, he saw a dead 70 to 80 pound deer on Highway 167, east of the Holy Hill entrance on Hill Road. Krueger was just able to lift the deer into the back of his truck with some effort. After he got the deer into the truck, he left the tailgate down and got into his cab to do the paperwork. The first I knew about it was when the truck shook, he said. I thought it might be the wind, but then it happened again, only stronger. The creature was standing on the ground, bent over the tailgate, reaching into the back of the truck. I froze for a few seconds, and then I threw the truck into drive and stepped on it to get out of there fast. It was reaching into the truck, and when I pulled away, it held on to the deer and pulled the deer off the truck. It had pointy ears, triangular-shaped. They looked like big wolf ears standing up on end. That was what made me realize it was not a bear. Its head was more like a wolf than a bear. Kruger guessed the creature's height at over 6 feet. After Channel 12 WISN Milwaukee broadcast a program on the Washington County werewolf, another witness reported he had seen the same creature 2 years before on Highway 60. This person did see the entire creature, and he said that it walked upright on its hind legs. A man went fishing for brook trout alone on the night of July 7, 2015. It was light enough out that he could see 50 feet ahead of him, even without his truck headlamps on. Driving in a deserted area, he saw what he thought was a person standing in the middle of the road about 20 feet away. He slowed down and turned his roof lights on. It was a creature about 7 feet tall, black with grayish silver parts, hunched over with a dead rabbit in its hands. Yes, hands with fingers and claws, as far as I could tell. Its feet seemed to be bent backwards. It turned its head and shoulders and looked right at me. I could see its yellow eyes shine, he said. He could also hear it growling at him in a low, low tone that made the hair stand up on his neck. At that point, he stepped on the gas in panic, half bracing for impact and closing his eyes for a brief second. The creature must have jumped to the side of the road as he passed. He saw nothing in the rearview mirrors and just kept going. He made it safely back to his cabin and sat down trying to calm himself when he heard something large walking around outside his cabin. He thought there may have even been two of them, but he wasn't sure. He had a phone but no network. He aimed it through the window shutters and took 3 photos of something that looks like a shadowed dog-shaped head. Those that seek distinction cannot give it up. When they let it go, they are grieved, and they will not look at a single example from which they might perceive the folly of their restless pursuits. Such people are under the doom of heaven. When the minds of some do not acknowledge this, it is because the gate of heaven in them has not been opened. Not knowing what is to come, how can we deny destiny? Not knowing what was before, how can we assert destiny? When things turn out as they ought, who can say that the agency is not supernatural? When things turn out otherwise, who can say that it is?
Wow.
Yeah. Ooh, wow. Wow.
So, Nicholas, what do you think of that?
Here's what I think. I think that at some level, your dad is always, one's dad, is always the best at what they do, you know? So if your dad is like a topiary artist for, you know, like a minor French manor, not Versailles, you know, just like some Comte or whatever. He's growing up, he's the best. He's the best. And as you enter into the larger symbolic order of society, you learn that maybe qualitatively in a competition of some sort, he's not maybe he's not the best, but he is to you, you know, always already the best. And so when I was a kid, my dad wanted me to become a pilot. And he started me off by trying to learn how to fly gliders or sailplanes. But I was too clever. I knew that he was already the best pilot in all the lands. So I never tried. I resolutely denied him his fantasy of his son learning to fly. My brother, the younger brother, younger sibling, he tried. He tried. And I'm sure he's still dealing with that in his own way. But I was too smart to do what my dad did. Sam was not.
Yeah, you know, part of it must just be natural. I mean, I talk a bit like my father, and a bit like my mom too, you know. But they are the people who taught me how to talk early on, all those years ago.
That is true, whether they liked it or not.
Yeah, so I hear that that's how to talk from them. And then obviously you live in a place where your parents live. So whatever the manner of talking in that area is like, some of that might rub off on
you. I think
you.
I see where you're going with this. Let me hazard an attempt, Steve. So you're saying if you're Sam Ashley, then your father was Robert Ashley. And if you're Sam Ashley, the place you grew up is probably a lot around your dad's operas. So, by extension, the only possible way of talking would be like your dad, Robert Ashley, in his operas.
Yeah. So there's all that. But, yeah, of course. No doubt Sam also interpreting and performing his father's talking work with his father in some instances probably also did lead to a certain similarity in approach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean,
could you imagine if by chance Sam Ashley's voice was actually more like Bobcat Goldthwait?
I don't know that voice.
Like if that's what it was like.
Okay.
Anyway.
Or like, well.
That was very lovely. That was delightful. So smooth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Well, I guess kind of like, it was a bit of foreign experiences or whatever that are also about westward expansion, but yeah, definitely more West Coast, if that's mm-hmm. even possible.
Yeah.
Well, it's true. I mean, literally to get closer to the West Coast was one of the reasons why I moved to California, because I was so enthralled by the approach to music on the West Coast. Art music, as they say, or what have you. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It is pretty good out here.
That was my hope. Anyway, I suppose I should... Oh, God. I'll go to the airport soon. So, let's wrap it up, folks. Good evening. Good morning, China. God. All right, it's time for bed.
Yeah.
Bye.
Bye. Good morning.